This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Paul Clements was the Democratic candidate challenging Fred Upton in Southwest Michigan's 6th Congressional District in 2014 and again in 2016. If he's going to be the Democratic nominee in 2018, he will have to emerge from a crowded primary. Clements is a political science professor at Western Michigan University, and he's one of 6 Democrats who are running for Congress in the 6th Congressional District. Paul Clements, thank you again for being here.
Thanks, Gordon. I'm grateful for the opportunity to speak to your listeners.
So reintroduce yourself to our audience, those who know you, perhaps introduce yourself to people who haven't heard of what you've done before, and tell us why you would again like to be the representative in Michigan's 6th Congressional District.
Thanks, Gordon. I teach national economic development and evaluation here at Western Michigan University in our graduate programs. My family and I have been long-term members of First Presbyterian Church, where I chaired our outreach committee. I got us involved in the Michigan Organizing Project. I was one of the founding board members for Michigan United. I was on the Dispute Resolution and Services Advisory Board of Griffin Place. We introduced peer mediation here. I was the founding chair of the Kalamazoo Interfaith Coalition for Peace and Justice. And Gordon, as you know, I was one of the founding founders of our Western Michigan University Climate Change Working Group. You know, I'm running because this is really a dark time for our country. I've been going around the district, and people know that Congress has not been working for a long time, that under President Trump, it's been getting a lot worse in many different areas. And, people feel that Congress has been neglecting their basic concerns, and that needs to change. We have the median wage in our district, which is just now getting back to where it was 20 years ago when corporate profits have been spiking. And still, we have seniors living in poverty. Healthcare costs. Many people cannot afford the copays or even still do not have insurance. Many of our students from here at Western are struggling under mountains of debt. And, you know, for the first time here in the United States, there are so many people who are concerned that the next generation, their kids, are not going to do as well as they did. And to turn that around, we have got to get Congress working effectively. Now, the biggest problem is money in politics, and Fred Upton has been a prime offender in this area. So I am certainly running for fundamental campaign finance reform to get that dark money out of politics. But in addition to that, there are 4 areas where we can make fundamental change that will make an enormous difference. The first one is we have a healthcare system that's twice expensive as other industrial countries and doesn't even provide as good health results. So I'm pushing for single-payer healthcare, where everyone can have access to basic health free of charge, where it covers dental, it covers mental health, it covers everything. People know that we have here in Kalamazoo, the infant mortality rate among African Americans is 4 times higher than it's been among whites, and the health system is not addressing it. Our health system has not addressed the opioid epidemic. We can turn this one around. Secondly, our education system simply is not preparing many of our kids for a 21st century economy. And this requires a lot of change, but we start with getting really excellent preschool and daycare for every single child. Tim Bartik in Kalamazoo has done some of the basic research showing that it pays $10 for every dollar you invest in terms of better health, better education outcomes. We need to do so much better in vocational, with apprenticeships, with restoring the vocational programs in our middle schools and high schools. Our K through 12, we've been testing kids to death. We've been not respecting and supporting our teachers. The way to turn that around is to figure out, we get the information out there of what are our proven methods that succeed in education, and giving teachers and administrators the information and supports they need to address those. We need to make community college and public university like this one free to get rid of that debt problem. And, you know, high school is not good enough anymore. We pay for that with a very small tax on stock transactions like other countries do to discourage speculation. Number 3, our criminal justice system, we have 2.3 million Americans behind bars, 3 to 5 times more the most industrial countries. Our criminal justice system is deeply biased and far too punitive. We can move about 1 million people from behind bars, from incarceration, back into the productive economy, back into the community. This is particularly a factor for our African-American community. They've been suffering the worst there, but it hurts all of us because we pay $35,000 a year to keep someone behind bars who, if we deal with substance abuse, if we decriminalize marijuana, if we deal with mental health issues through our public health system rather than our criminal justice system, it'll save enormous sums of money. Our communities will be working better, and we'll be better off overall. And fourth, we need to have a forward-looking economic policy. And that starts with investing in areas of greater demand, such as renewable energy, instead of coal. I mean, come on. But it's also food. America's a food exporter. One more thing, and that is part of forward-looking economy is a 21st century infrastructure with major investments in that area. And I see you want to get into here, Gordon. Go ahead.
Well, one of the things you say on your website is that we need to do something to address the federal debt and deficit.
Certainly.
If you're going to invest in infrastructure, if you're going to make college affordable or even, you know, free for, you know, depending on where people fall in income,
sure.
If you're going to have a single-payer healthcare system that covers everything that you mentioned, can you do all that and at the same time bring down the debt and deficit?
You certainly can. I've already mentioned that you get the money for the education through a small speculation tax. With healthcare, it actually makes healthcare cheaper to cut out those enormous administrative expenses and profiteering. And when you're focusing on keeping people healthy rather than just fixing disease when it gets to be really serious. In terms of the infrastructure program, you know, this tax scam that Fred Upton pushed, that's adding $1.5 trillion to the deficit while also cutting taxes enormously for big corporations and for millionaires, I would work to repeal that and use some of those resources for the infrastructure investments that we need. And the point is that all of these are just good investments that pay for themselves far more than what you're investing, than what you're spending. So we can do that and reduce the deficit and also build a much stronger, more inclusive economy.
Is unfair trade hurting American workers?
Yes, it is. We still have supports. We still give tax breaks for corporations when they move jobs overseas. Some of our NAFTA, some of our trade deals allow for corporate negotiations when there's any kind of dispute where the local governments, where the workers don't have any kind of role. So we still do have some unfair trade, and I certainly want to work to address that one as well. But if we compare that to the basics of education and healthcare and infrastructure, it's 10 to 1.
So specifically, though, on trade, is President Trump right to impose tariffs or propose tariffs on steel and aluminum?
This is such a bad move that Trump has made. Number one, it's going to raise costs for manufactured items, and it's particularly going to hurt Michigan because a lot of Michigan companies use aluminum and steel. It's just going to raise those costs. Number two, it seems very likely to spark a trade war, and a trade war is going to be disastrous for everybody.
What would make a sensible gun policy that you would be willing to vote for if you're a member of Congress?
You know, the first thing we need to recognize about gun policy is that we've got to get our Congress out of the stranglehold of the National Rifle Association. That's what's been blocking things. We've got to be able to actually do research on how to improve gun safety. And this is one thing where Fred Upton has not been willing to have a vote on allowing that kind of research to take place when he's been chairing the relevant committees. But, you know, these terrible massacres in our schools, it's time to get rid of assault rifles, for sure. It's time to have, you know, comprehensive background checks, not just spot checking, but for everyone, whether it's on the internet or whether it's at a gun show. It's time to raise the age to 21 years for when you can buy a weapon. We don't need to have teenagers out there holding, carrying guns. Those are certainly things that I would support.
Would you support things like red flag bills, which, you know, allow someone to petition a court to say that someone is mentally ill and therefore they should not own a firearm?
Yeah, I think that those are reasonable proposals. Yes.
Do you think that someone should be able? But, you know, I guess where would you draw the line on, you know, what sort of gun someone can own? You say assault weapons. You know, is a shotgun sort of where you draw the line? Say you can own a shotgun, not anything more powerful than that.
Yeah, I certainly support, you know, hunters and people having guns for personal protection, but being able to fire, you know, 60 rounds in a minute is just not necessary.
One of the things you say on your website is that you want to reform the Democratic Party. What do you think the Democratic Party has done wrong that you think it needs reform in, you know, its system of, you know, electing candidates and those sort of things?
I was really disappointed that in 2016 that the National Democratic Party, that they got behind Hillary Clinton before she won the nomination. And that's just not right. That's not fair. It's for the people to decide, not for the party to decide who the candidate should be. And up until the time when, you know, there's the primary, the National Party should not be supporting one candidate over the other.
There were some emails that went back and forth, and there was some, you know, some talk in there about some mischief and those sort of things. Do you see anything, though, where actually anything was done that actually put a thumb on the scale? Or was this just some people saying, hey, we would prefer Hillary?
My understanding is, and I don't have all the details on this, is that the National Democratic Party, their infrastructure of campaign support was pushing more for Hillary than it was for Bernie. That Bernie was not getting all the supports that Hillary was getting. I think it really was. You know, it's hard to know when you have something like this, like, you know, like with the Russians getting involved with Trump. It's hard to know how many votes it affected, but we don't need that.
You mentioned earlier the NRA. You also mentioned campaign finance. So those two things are obviously well connected. Well, what specifically would you want to see Congress do on campaign finance, realizing that at least for now, Citizens United is, you know, the law of the land because of the Supreme Court?
Campaign finance is absolutely the biggest reason that our Congress, and for that matter, our federal government, are not working to address the needs of the people, that they're working to focus on the needs of the very wealthy who can have the armies of lobbyists and lawyers. So the first thing is transparency. Congress can certainly do this, make sure that any expenditure for any political purpose has to be reported and made public. If we want to get so that the candidates do not depend on big donations, there are other things we can do. Like one proposal out there is to say, all right, every voter can have a $50 ticket that they get from the federal government, and that would be matched by maybe 4 or 5 to 1, and so then they can give that to the candidate of their choice. Let's say in a congressional election, and that way, then you don't have to go for the big money, but you do have to go for the support of lots of people within your district. That's one example, but there are other examples out there. If Congress wants to do it, whatever the Supreme Court is saying, we can find a way to do it.
Would you favor greater transparency? One of the things Citizens United does say is that, you know, we can reveal the identities of donors either, you know, through federal or state elections.
Gordon, I just mentioned that, yes, that we certainly need to have complete transparency in all political spending, any kind of political spending by a corporation, by, you know, whomever, maybe, I don't know, above $100 limit or $200 limit. That's okay with me if people, you know. But it should all be publicly reported so people know who's paying their politicians and how much.
You mentioned education as one of your issues. You know, how much should the federal government even be doing on education, and how much should the federal government be leaving that state by state, school district by school district to make those decisions?
You know, historically, education has been primarily a local and state issue. But the problem is that our states, and Michigan in particular, is failing. And this is too fundamentally important, Gordon, for our country to leave it alone. So I think the federal government does need to play a stronger role. Now, right now, we spend a little over $700 billion a year on the military, and that's only when you count the core budget. There's a lot more than that beyond that. And we spend only $70 billion, 10%, on education. There's a lot of waste. It's time for a good audit for the Pentagon. There's some areas like our nuclear forces. We have more nuclear warheads than we need for any kind of deterrent purposes. There are areas where we can cut that military spending without reducing the safety of our country. I think if we cut that by, let's say, 10% and double the education spending, not to tell people what to do, but to, as I already said, let's get the evidence of what has succeeded in education, in secondaries, in school, in mathematics, in vocational, and then give the school districts, give the teachers, give the administrators and parents the models that have succeeded and support for implementing those. Because if you don't have the local people involved, it's just not going to work.
You also mentioned in their military spending and the military budget. You know, what's your priority there? What do you think the things are that are central to United States security and therefore, you know, probably are, you know, a little more untouchable than other things in the military budget? And what are the things you think we're probably spending money on right now that you would be willing to cut in order to put the money elsewhere?
I mentioned that I was one of the founding chair of the Kalamazoo Interfaith Coalition for Peace and Justice. And we got started when America was getting set to invade Iraq. And it was under false pretenses or based on lies. And we said that was a bad idea. And the biggest way that our military expenses have been going up has been getting involved in foreign wars that we just do not need to be fighting. So that's the biggest thing to turn around. But in terms of specific programs, I've already mentioned that our nuclear stockpile is far more than we need for deterrent purposes, and the Pentagon has acknowledged this. The Pentagon has acknowledged that as we've been pushing more and more money into the military, that just basic good financial practices have not been followed, and so just auditing and cutting that kind of waste can reduce a substantial amount. Our missile defense program has not been proven to be successful. I think that some funding could be cut there. We need to continue the research there, but if it's not going to work, you don't want to throw, you know, good money after bad. There are a number of areas that can be cut. In terms of what we need to maintain, we need to certainly maintain support for our troops and for our veterans, for their basic, keeping up with the cost of living, for our veterans' hospitals. I've talked with veterans, I've spoken with people involved in the healthcare administration for the veterans, and I think that for the most part, it's doing pretty well. But where there is room for improvement, I certainly would want to push for those improvements.
So a number of times you've mentioned that what we really need is good information when it comes to guns, when it comes to education. Climate change. You know, what more do we need to know at this point? I think a lot of people in your field would say we know what we need to know. So how do we move on then to actually getting things done to address climate change?
The number one requirement for effective action on climate change, because it is a global issue, is American leadership. That's why that's the reason that we have not had effective global action up until now. So for Trump to move us backward on this is basically, you know, in terms of the consequences, it's just about criminal. It's going to cause, sadly, because it's stopping forward movement addressing climate change, it's going to cause probably many deaths. Now, for American leadership, we have to bring back leadership. We have to get back into the Paris Climate Agreement and then push for a stronger agreement with the Paris Climate Agreement that has actual fixed carbon emissions for each country that are monitored effectively. And then for the United States, we have to do our part. What does that mean? Right now, our carbon emissions are about 19 tons per person per year. And for this to work, we've got to get it down to about 2 tons per person per year by 2050. That's pretty significant reduction. We can do it. The cost of solar and wind and other renewable energy has been going down dramatically. It's technically completely feasible, and it will not be very costly economically. It'll be better for us in the long run. But sadly, President Trump and Fred Upton have for many years pushed in the opposite direction.
You say in the long run it'll be better, but won't there be some people in the short term who do suffer economically as we make this shift? They may be working in something like coal. They may be working in the fossil fuel industry, and they may feel some economic hurt, at least in the short term.
Yeah, with any major change, there's going to be some short-term costs. But this is one example of how our vocational programs have failed us. That we, in a dynamic economy, there are going to be some sectors that go down, and we invest half of what other countries do in retraining people who lose their jobs for the jobs that employers need. So if we have a much stronger vocational program for adults, for people who lose their positions, then that can address some of these concerns. The other thing is that if we do not address this, and you know, if New Orleans gets flooded and Southern Florida gets flooded, the consequence is going to be a lot worse.
immigration policy, what would be the thing that would get Paul Clements' vote in Congress?
We need to have comprehensive immigration reform. Gordon, my wife and I have been very active in supporting a Syrian refugee family, helping them to make it here in Kalamazoo, and they're doing very well. The fact that we only take 10,000 refugees, or we haven't even hit that, out of Syria when Germany takes a million, isn't right. But here in the United States, the fact that, you know, I think the immediate priority has to be the Dreamers, because they're living in limbo right now, and they should not have to leave the country where they've spent most of their lives. So the first thing to do is to give a pathway to citizenship for the Dreamers. You know, maybe if there's been a heinous crime, a serious felony, then there could be some exceptions. But for most of them, for almost all of them, they need that's the first priority. Then if we look a little bit further, then, you know, if you've got 11 million undocumented people working in the United States, we know that most of those people are contributing positively economically, that the crime rates are actually lower among undocumented than it is among citizens. And so the question is, do we want a two-tier society? Do we want to have regular citizenship and some people living below the radar? That's not what we want for our country. So I think, again, that in the long term, we need to have a pathway to citizenship for all those who've been here for a long time, who are contributing, who have not committed serious criminal offenses. And then certainly tighten up we do need to protect the borders. And I think the key there is actually probably paying more attention to people who are coming in legally on visas and just overstaying their limits. And there are ways to address that.
So as I noted, you are making your third run at this congressional seat. The last two times, you were the only Democrat who got in the race. What does the fact that there are five other candidates who would like the Democratic nomination say to you?
Well, I think it's great. I think that having a lot more conversations across the district and holding Fred Upton accountable for his history of failing to not being willing to participate in town meetings, for the fact that he gets way over half of his campaign finance money from out of state, mostly sourced from companies that he regulates, that he's been hurting our health care, that he's been pushing this tax scam. I think having this discussion going on in more places around the district is only for the better.
If there's a Democrat out there that really wants to win in November, and you're thinking, hey, Paul Clements ran twice and he didn't win, so maybe one of these other candidates is the right one to win this seat, which has been a Republican seat for as long as anyone can remember. What's the argument you would make to them to give you another look?
You know, Gordon, this is really a different political moment than what we've had in 2016, for sure. If we look at what happened after 2016 election, there was just a wave of political activity, and you know this, with people calling Fred for the first time on his failure to hold town meetings, weekly demonstrations in front of Fred's St. Joe office, and almost weekly here in Kalamazoo, calling him on his dark money history. So Fred has been held accountable in a way that he has not before. Then when he flip-flopped on health care back in May, and he pushed a health care plan that would have kicked 40,000 people off health insurance in our district, well, that hurt him. At that time, his approval rating in our district fell to 39%, a number we haven't seen before. Now, I wasn't sure if I was going to run again, but I looked at that, and I thought, well, maybe this is something. I looked at the other candidates, the Democrats, who at that time were coming forward, and I felt that, you know, I bring the strongest package, both in terms of pushing forward the kind of agenda we need in Congress and in terms of defeating Fred. I did my own poll. It put me, this was in June, it put me at 42 to 44. Fred had 44, I had 42, but within the margin of error, a lot better than what I had seen before. And then in December, when Fred had been pushing this tax scam that adds $1.5 trillion to the deficit, that mostly gives to millionaires, then his approval fell to 34%. It fell 5% more. I've got the most experience running a campaign. I'm running the strongest campaign. I'm going to be the candidate in Congress who can, the congressman who can push forward the agenda that is really going to substantially improve the well-being of the people of this district. And so I think I'm the best.
I just want to note on what you mentioned there about approval rating and polls. The last several election cycles, even before you got into this, I have heard that there was a poll out there which showed Fred Upton was in trouble or he was vulnerable. And so far, that really hasn't shown up in the results of the November general election. So how do you take the data you have, which does show that, you know, there's an opening here, and actually go and close the deal with voters in November?
One is that we have to continue to hold Upton accountable for his failure to be responsive to the voters in terms of he's been unwilling to hold town hall meetings. He's been undermining our health care. He's been pushing for tax reform that serves the interest of millionaires. He is a prime offender in the dark money game, in the corporate finance game. He's been one of the people who has blocked information on how we can have more effective gun safety and gun control. Holding him accountable for his record. You have to have the resources to do that. You run a couple times, and every time you run, like most things in life, experience helps. And I think that I'll be able to be more effective than our other Democratic candidates in holding Fred accountable, as I have on today's show. Secondly, I have built up over time, the people, I have the strongest name recognition, the strongest loyalty out across the district. And in terms of promoting an agenda that speaks to the deep dissatisfaction that people have with our Congress, that speaks to the fundamental changes that our government needs to make if it's going to be responsive to the concerns of the people of this district, I'm the candidate who's got that message.
Fred Upton has been in Congress now for over 30 years. This part of Southwest Michigan has been represented by a Republican for a couple decades now. You go back to Howard Wolpe in the 90s, would have been the last time that a Democrat represented any part of this state, this section of the state. There's a couple different theories about how you flip a seat. One is that you run a candidate who Republicans, since it seems to be a lean Republican district, would feel comfortable voting for. Another theory is that you get the base of the Democratic Party, the left, really excited and get them to turn out in November. Which one of those two, or if you have a different theory, what other third way is there that you win a seat for the Democrats, which they haven't held in a long, long time?
Well, the first thing, Gordon, is that President Obama won this district, that our Democratic senators have won this district, that it's Fred's pretense of bipartisanship that up until now people have bought that allowed him to keep winning the district, but that has worn thin for so many people. In terms of the options you describe, it's not just those. Yes, we're going to see a very different turnout in 2018, and I'm working to make this happen in terms of some people who didn't come out in 2016 who just were not excited enough. So yes, we do need to excite the Democrats. But we've also got to speak to the substantial, probably a majority of people. You don't register for parties in Michigan, but there are a substantial majority who are not deeply committed to Democratic Party or Republican Party, who actually look at the races. And they're the ones who understand that Congress has been failing. And I think that the evidence shows that Upton has been part of the problem, that we are not addressing their concerns that I've been talking about throughout our interview. And when they see that they've got a chance, we look at what happened in 2016. Both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump were running against Washington because Washington was failing them. Now, Trump told a lot of lies. Bernie actually had a clear analysis, but I think that anger and dissatisfaction is still out there because Trump certainly has not been solving people's problems, and that's what I'm going to be running to speak to.
Would you say you are trying to run something of a campaign which is similar to what Bernie Sanders had or the message that Bernie Sanders had in 2016?
I was grateful that Bernie endorsed me in 2014 and 2016. I didn't mention that I've got a bachelor's from Harvard and a PhD in public affairs from Princeton, as I teach national economic development, I teach about what has allowed governments to succeed or where have they failed, why have they failed when they have failed in their national economic and social policies. So I do think that sometimes Bernie was visionary without necessarily getting all the ducks in a row in terms of how you carry things through. I recognize that we need to compromise sometimes, that we need to work with the other side. I think the areas that I've talked about, education and criminal justice reform and infrastructure, there are a lot of Republicans who want to see progress there. And whether we have, I expect we'll have a Democratic majority, but whether we do or not, I'm going to work with both sides to make these things happen.
Paul Clements, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
Paul Clements is one of six Democrats running for Congress in Southwest Michigan's 6th Congressional District. The winner of the August primary will challenge Republican Congressman Fred Upton in the fall. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.